Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. Well, since March of last year, I have been periodically checking in with some medical researchers and infectious disease experts to talk about our pandemic reality. Things have changed substantially since that first Q&A on March 19th of 2020. At the time, Utah had seen only about 100 COVID-19 cases, and there had been zero deaths. Flash forward 18 months, and we have seen about 500,000 infections in Utah, and we are close to surpassing the 3,000 death mark here in the Beehive State. Globally, coronavirus has killed nearly 5 million people and counting. There have been incredible successes, though, through it all, chief among them, the development of effective vaccines. But there have also been incredible setbacks, perhaps most glaringly the spread of misinformation, the resulting reticence of some people to get vaccinated or follow public health guidelines, and also the emergence of a highly contagious variant that has dealt a significant setback to humanity's battle against this tiny invader. So where are we in the pandemic? What activities are safe to engage in, to the extent that they can be, for those who are vaccinated? How big of a deal is the potential expansion of vaccines to kids aged 5 to 11? And, well, will the pandemic ever end? Let me welcome to the show now my recurring guests. Dr. Emily Spivak is an infectious disease physician at the University of Utah. And welcome, Dr. Spivak. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Stephen Goldstein is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Utah specializing in coronavirus evolution. Dr. Goldstein, thank you for being here as well.
Thanks, Roger.
Well, I've got a few layman's questions to pose to the experts, and so excuse my sounding totally naive throughout this interview. And I think that first and foremost, I want to start with that latest news, the fact that after clinical trials, Pfizer says that its vaccine is safe and creates strong protection in kids ages 5 to 11. They are requesting emergency use authorization to use the vaccine in that age group. And maybe I'll just ask for your reactions here to begin with. Emily Spivak, why don't we start with you? Supposedly before Halloween, we might see younger kids beginning to get vaccinated. What do you think about this jump forward?
Yeah. Well, as a parent of three kids under the age of 11, one is three, so would not be eligible. I think this is huge. So clearly, I haven't seen the data, right? This is all in a press release from Pfizer. But based on our experience in adults and teenagers, I am very confident that the vaccine will be effective and safe in this younger age group as well. And clearly, you know, we are seeing a huge rise in cases, not just in Utah, but across the nation and school-aged children that are now accounting for about 25% of all COVID-19 cases since the school year began sort of around the country. And I think 30,000 kids were admitted around the country for COVID in August alone, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, I think it has huge implications for vulnerable kids, for kids who just want to go to sports practice, for kids who want to go to school and not have to quarantine if they get exposed. And as a parent, I'm super excited because I actually do feel like even for my one family, it would start to help things get back to normal a bit more.
And Dr. Goldstein, and you know, an important step here, I guess, how do you view it as a milestone in our fight against COVID-19?
Yeah, so I think every additional age group we're able to roll this vaccine out to is another milestone kind of on our path out of this pandemic. I agree completely with everything Dr. Spivak said. I think it's going to make a huge difference for a lot of families that want to be able to send their kids to school without the, you know, anxiety of exposure and potential quarantine. I know, you know, our daughter is younger still than this cutoff will be, but I understand that kind of anxiety that comes with sending a kid to daycare or school, wondering if today's going to be the day you go into 10-day quarantine or potentially have an exposure for your family. But, you know, the big question is going to be, how is the uptake as it has been with adults? Is our parents going to go and get their kids vaccinated? So we need to, you know, not just celebrate the milestone of the vaccine being potentially authorized in kids ages 5 to 11, but come up with a smart way to get parents to get their kids in that age group vaccinated.
And there are some reasons why people, you know, certain segments of the population have been hesitant to get the vaccines. Some of that having to do with misinformation and confused information, you know, out there on the internet and so on. Just on the idea of kids, younger kids getting vaccinated, I know that there have been in some younger adults in particular, there have been some very rare side effects. For example, you've got heart inflammation in a very few, you know, younger adults being one of those side effects. And I think that we can predict that there will be some percentage of younger kids having some side effects from getting the vaccine. Can either of you help us kind of understand that particular risk versus the risk of a child getting COVID versus the maybe larger societal risk, the risk to society itself of the continued spread of COVID? They're all the same question, but just broken up into different components.
So I don't have all the numbers, you know, stashed away in my head, but I can say that, you know, if you don't get vaccinated, the chances of eventually getting COVID are 100% at some point over the next couple of years, say. And so, you know, even for children, there are significant risks of getting, you know, even though the risk of dying may be quite low, it's certainly not zero. The risk of getting sick and quite sick is certainly there. And, you know, I've seen the absolute numbers calculated on a population level that, you know, the number of, for example, hospitalizations in children that are prevented by a million vaccinations in like the 5 to 11 age group outstrips by a large margin the number of potential myocarditis cases in those same age groups of children, most of which are pretty mild and self-limiting is my understanding. But, you know, I'm not the world's leading expert on that particular question, but I do think that even for children where the risk of a poor outcome from COVID is relatively low compared to adults, the risk-benefit calculus for the vaccine still clearly comes out in favor of it being a benefit, both at an individual level and then also, of course, at a societal level, keeping schools open, keeping summer programs open, keeping vulnerable adults that children are coming to contact with protected from spread in schools and camps and things like that, all line up on the side of vaccinating as many kids as we can.
Dr. Spivak, do you want to weigh in on that as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the way to say it simply is it's no contest. I mean, like Dr. Goldstein said, you know, I don't know the exact numbers. I do know there's data from Israel, you know, with their huge vaccination campaign, 2 million people age 16 and older who've gotten the vaccine and found that COVID is far more likely to cause heart problems than the vaccine is. And all, again, to my knowledge, in the U.S., all of the myocarditis cases have been self-limiting, never needed to be hospitalized. So it's no contest. And I've also heard people hypothesize, I don't know how this is going to bear out, but that it may be even less likely for kids who are under the age of 11 to get myocarditis because of thinking about the sort of muscle mass of the heart and that they may have less muscle mass than, let's say, you know, a teenage boy does, and that there may actually be a decreasing risk, or we may have already seen this sort of higher risk in the youth age. Whether that's going to pan out or not, I have no idea. But regardless, the point is you're much more likely to get myocarditis from COVID and end up in the hospital, long-term symptoms, get your family sick, et cetera. So it's not even, there's not even a contest there.
Okay. With the Delta variant, we're seeing more significant or more serious outcomes, more hospitalizations for kids. Is that correct to say, or is it just that there's greater spread in general of coronavirus?
You know, for adults, you know, I think it's pretty clear. Some of it's anecdotal from what we're seeing here, you know, in Utah, in University of Utah, but there is some data on this. And clearly you've heard experience from around the country, sort of in the Southeast where the Delta surge hit first. And our ICU docs tell me here, they're like, something is different about this version of the virus than, you know, last year and even with the UK variant and how severely ill these sometimes otherwise healthy younger adults are. And so I think for adults, there's no question that something is different and the cases are more severe. For kids, I honestly can't speak to that, not being a pediatric infectious disease physician. I think some of it clearly is just that we are seeing just huge, so many more cases in kids than we did a year ago. It's harder to know if it's actually more severe versus just, you know, we never had this many infections sort of this early in the fall last year and early winter to know, you know, if our hospitalizations would have gotten this high.
Stephen Goldstein, I remember reading at some point that getting more kids vaccinated was an important step towards achieving this sort of difficult thing to get to, I guess, herd immunity. Is that something we should add to the discussion, herd immunity? And do you also maybe want to remind us in layman's terms what we're talking about when we say herd immunity? What is that? And does kids, you know, being opened up to getting the vaccine get us closer to it?
So herd immunity is an epidemiological concept wherein when you have a sufficient, if you have a vaccine that prevents infection, that prevents people from getting infected and transmitting the virus, if you get to a certain percentage of the population that's vaccinated with that vaccine, they're no longer susceptible to the virus and the virus can't spread within the population anymore because there aren't enough susceptible hosts for the virus to sustain epidemics. It'll just, if one person might get infected, but they're not going to come into contact with enough susceptible people to continue to propagate the epidemic. You know, I think with these vaccines and with this virus, it's not the most helpful concept, frankly, for us to be thinking about. I don't think, you know, it's very difficult with a respiratory virus to prevent infection and transmission sufficiently to establish herd immunity, especially when we have a virus that's as contagious as this virus is. What we really need to just think about now, that doesn't mean that the vaccine won't help reduce transmission in our community. It clearly will. The vaccines clearly do help reduce virus transmission, but they're not, we're not going to reach some magical number where the virus just goes away, is kind of the point that I'm getting at. We need to be prepared to vaccinate ourselves to the highest level possible so that we can live with a constant, hopefully low level circulation of this virus. If we don't vaccinate it at a high level, we're going to have continued high level circulation of this virus, what we're living with right now. And that's not really an outcome that's acceptable. But I don't think we're going to reach some threshold where the virus is just going to go away because we vaccinated enough people. Vaccinating kids will help us get to that, push it down to the lowest level possible, which will mean the lowest amount of transmission, lowest amount of hospitalization and death, lowest amount of disruption to our lives. You know, whether that's socially, school, work, all of those things, you know, the way to bring those things back the way we want them is through vaccination, herd immunity or not.
Is it, just to clarify on that point, is it a question then of, you know, not of preventing people from getting COVID, but of just ensuring that when a person does get COVID, which we should assume they will do eventually, that they will have some level of protection? You know, are we all going to get this, I guess, Dr. Goldstein, one way or another?
We are all going to be exposed to this virus, that's for sure. Some percentage of us, our vaccination will completely protect us from infection. That's going to depend on what variant we are exposed to. It's going to depend on probably how long since our last vaccination dose we are when we were exposed. It's complicated. And we don't have great estimates for how effective the vaccines are at preventing against any infection at all with Delta. So meaning any virus replication in your body at all. But we are all going to be exposed to this. Many of us will get it. And definitely a major goal. You know, if we remember, if we go back to the clinical trials for these vaccines, they were tested for preventing, not preventing infection. They were tested for preventing disease caused by this virus. And that I think still should be the major outcome, is how do we turn this virus from something that is really bad news to something that if you get it, maybe you're home for a couple of days, few days from work, but ultimately no worse outcome than that. And that is still, at a population level, probably the biggest benefit we can get from these vaccines, is turning this into a nuisance infection, as opposed to this incredibly disruptive force that it is in our lives right now.
Hmm. I want to kind of zoom out. I don't know how to dip into these topics. There's, I guess, one I want to get to is virus evolution, the emergence of variants. We've talked about this before, and I'll stick with you for a moment here, Dr. Goldstein, since this is kind of in your wheelhouse. The Delta variant, its emergence on the global stage has been pretty devastating. Can you just remind us where variants actually come from? Like, how do they come to be?
So every time the virus replicates itself, every time a new copy is made, the virus errors are made. Virus replication is just imperfect process by design. And so these variants emerge when a collection of mutations accumulate and give the virus different properties than it had before. So in the case of the Delta variant, that's a little bit of immune evasion. So the virus, the Delta variant, is a little bit less susceptible to the immunity afforded by prior infection or vaccination, and then a large increase in transmissibility, the Delta variant. This variant is much more contagious than the original version of this virus that we dealt with back in 2020. And so these variants can emerge just through the natural course of the virus replicating throughout the human population. The more infection there is, the more times the virus genome is copied and the more errors are made. And so these variants emerge, are more likely to emerge when there's a large uncontained epidemic, which is probably why the Delta variant emerged out of India, for example, last summer when they had a huge uncontained epidemic. We had various variants arise in the United States last winter. We just got lucky that none of them turned out to be quite as bad as the Delta variant turns out to be right now.
Yeah. And I don't want to linger on this particular point for too long, but there are some, you might call them popular media voices out there, people like the podcaster Joe Rogan, who've made the suggestion that vaccination itself is selecting for variants. And maybe just to do a little bit of fact checking, the idea there is that by getting vaccinated, you're somehow allowing for the selection of stronger or more deadly variants. Does that make any sense at all, Dr. Goldstein?
So, I mean, there's a little bit of truth in that, in the sense that when you have a vaccinated population, you are putting a selective pressure on the virus, because in a vaccinated population, a virus that can evade vaccination immunity will have an advantage. Yeah. It will survive, and viruses that can't won't. But that is outweighed by the effect of the vaccine in suppressing the amount of viral replication on a global scale. And variants emerge when the virus is able to replicate unencumbered. And so the benefit afforded by vaccination of suppressing viral replication on a population level outweighs any potential concerns about selecting for immune-resistant variants through vaccination.
Cool. I want to talk about how those of us who are vaccinated ought to be behaving. I mean, you know, for people who are not just concerned about, say, their own personal risk, but are concerned about community spread and not wanting to contribute to that, what's appropriate for people like myself who are, you know, who is fully vaccinated to be doing? And I think maybe the place to start there is with a kind of basic question, which is, if I'm vaccinated, how likely is it that I am carrying the virus and then spreading it around? And what kind of a risk does that present to the larger society? And Dr. Spivak, do you want to jump in there to start, maybe?
Sure. I mean, I don't know that maybe Dr. Goldstein could, but I doubt it. I don't know that I can give you an actual like probability that you as a vaccinated person, obviously it's going to vary state to state, right? Whether you're here or Wyoming or Massachusetts or whatever, because there's different community spread, are going to be potentially carrying it. But I'd say in general, if you're vaccinated, it's low. I'd say if you're vaccinated and you never wear a mask and you go to large indoor concerts or always eat indoor in restaurants, you teach in public schools in Utah where kids aren't vaccinated, not wearing masks, that the chances of you carrying it may go up. So the way I think about this is I'm going to tell you in general, as a fully vaccinated person in my 40s, I am not worried for the most part about my own health and getting COVID and something bad happening to me, other than what Dr. Goldstein mentioned before, which is I would have probably at worst a flu-like illness that I'd have to be home for a while. But I do have unvaccinated children at home, and clearly I care about, you know, the rest of the community and don't want to give it to other people. So when I am in public settings, like, I don't know, in a grocery store, or in a restaurant, although I'll say I just am super cautious and don't go to restaurants much, you know, I wear a mask inside all the time because I want to decrease the risk that I pick up something. Not that I'm worried about my own health necessarily, because, you know, again, the vaccines are very good against breakthrough severe infections. I may get a breakthrough minor infection that's an inconvenience, but I'm not going to probably be hospitalized and die. But I do that so that I don't carry it, pick it up unknowingly, and then spread it to my kids. So, you know, when people ask that question to me, the answer really depends on, is it your personal risk you're worried about, or is it the risk to the loved ones close around you, and then working out from there just sort of what the risks are, if that makes sense. I mean, I tend to be on the very diligent side of this because, again, this is the world I've been living for now, whatever it's been, almost 2 years feels like. And so I try and get that risk almost as close to zero as I can. Does everybody have to do that? No, I don't think so. And I think, you know, a benefit of being fully vaccinated is that you are very highly protected. And I think that's okay for then to people let their guard down in some places and maybe not wear their mask as much as I do, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Top level, Dr. Goldstein, I mean, do you, I have like sort of specific, Emily already mentioned one of them, going to restaurants. It's a question that I have, like, should I, as a fully vaccinated person, feel comfortable going and sitting down at an indoor restaurant to eat? Obviously, there's a whole bunch of considerations there. Do you have kids in the house? Do you have people you're coming into contact with who have comorbidities? How big is the restaurant? But do you want to start with the top level? How we ought to be thinking about how much spread an individual is capable of doing when they are vaccinated?
I think it's hard to have a top level thing, because I think, as Dr. Spivak pointed out, once you're vaccinated, I think it becomes more of a personal risk calculus. You know, before we were all equally capable of both getting sick and then also propagating community spread. Once you're vaccinated, you know, if you're infected, you are less likely to transmit that infection forward. So it is a little bit a question of, you know, are you trying really hard to not get sick at all? Or are you willing, or are you comfortable accepting a little bit higher risk of a breakthrough infection, knowing that if you're vaccinated, that's likely to be mild, assuming that you're, you know, not in intense contact with people who aren't vaccinated. If you have kids, you know, you might want to take extra precautions, like Dr. Spivak was saying, to protect your kids, to protect their classrooms, and things like that. So, but in general, I think it is okay for people who are vaccinated to live their lives a little bit more. I think that's a good thing. I think that's a healthy thing and a genuine benefit of vaccination that we should, you know, account for
and embrace, I guess. How about things like, you know, getting on a plane and flying? How comfortable do the two of you feel on that score? I mean, I want to recognize or sort of underscore the fact that you're not offering, you know, any specific medical advice to anybody in particular. But if, you know, for an otherwise healthy, fully vaccinated person, plane travel, what do you guys think?
I think it's fine. Yeah. I think there's also this misconception of, based on how this pandemic started, and that there's something inherently dangerous about airplanes. I mean, maybe that's a separate discussion, but airplanes, again, if you're fully vaccinated and you're adhering to the airline requirements of wearing a mask, it actually might be one of the safer places to be, right? There's very good air circulation, HEPA filters, high number of air exchanges, meaning the air is going through the filter many times during the flight. I think we have this thing, right? We're like, travel, dangerous, COVID. And I actually tell people, tell me what you've done in Salt Lake City or in Utah for the last week. And I'm pretty sure I can make the case to you that you are at much higher risk of getting COVID with those things that you did in Utah in the last year, socially potentially, than getting on the airplane. It could be that travel, again, if you're going to a place that has less COVID than you have here in Utah, it could be a good thing. And you could be going to a safer environment.
What about just in terms of risks and activities? I'm thinking about fully vaccinated households going and, you know, hanging out in other fully vaccinated households, you know, at a dinner party, or going to say hello to your friends who are fully vaccinated in their homes. What do you guys think about that at this point?
I think that's fine. I think people should be doing that sort of thing. It's good. I mean, if there's no social benefit to vaccination, then I think the absolute benefits of it are a lot less appealing to most people. And I think that being able to resume at least a significant part of our social lives is a huge benefit to vaccination, and something that we should embrace and hold up as absolutely a reason to get vaccinated. So I'm totally on board with that.
And Emily, you too?
Yeah, the one thing I'd add to it, again, it's because wherever I go, my kids go, is that if kids come with me, the kids wear masks in houses, again, because they're all not vaccinated. And you know, there may be situations, I haven't come across one where we would socialize with a fully vaccinated, mean everyone that, right? Depending on who's in a family.
Right,
It's hard to get a fully vaccinated family if there's kids, that we may not wear a mask, but that's never happened to me again, because I don't want my kids to get COVID. It's incredibly inconvenient for parenting and schooling. And so I would just make a plug to people. Remember that those under 12 are not vaccinated. And the kids are fine. They know how to wear masks. If you're socializing inside, put masks on the kids if you can. But I agree with Dr. Goldstein. I have socialized with adults, fully vaccinated, maskless inside. And I think it's,
There are probably a lot of other places we could go with this line of questioning about behaviors, but we're really low on time. And so I want to just move on to one more aspect of this. And it's that the United States, you know, is now one of the least vaccinated countries in the developed world, or maybe among wealthy nations, we should say. Developed is kind of a loaded term. I'm wondering, though, if we can talk about how the low rate of vaccination, or the comparatively low rate of vaccination, is impacting our healthcare system. And Dr. Spivak, you are at the, you know, the U of U at the hospital there is where you are based. And I'm wondering if you can just sort of talk about how things are going in American healthcare right now at this point in the pandemic.
Not good. You know, we have, right, I think today is the highest ICU hospitalization rate ever, if I'm not mistaken, for COVID-19 across the state. And we are seeing just really sick, unvaccinated people. And to sort of our prior comment, because the two intertwine, it's very clear it is the unvaccinated population that is driving all of this. They are the vast majority of cases. They are almost all of our hospitalizations. And you know, everyone's heard this. I honestly don't really think people care, but I will say it if you want me to say it, that everyone's tired, everyone's worn out. You know, we have incredible staffing shortages. So we are skimping kind of, you know, on some of the care and things that we do, because we just have, you know, it's sort of plug and chug, and, you know, people just are burned out, and we don't have the resources to do all the things that we usually do. It's not good, but I'll be frankly honest with you, the hospital sort of argument about how healthcare is doing and this, I don't think people care. Because it's so abstract, it's so far removed from anything that they think will ever affect them. Right, we have these arguments of if you're in a car accident or if you have a heart attack, which is true, we may not have room for you because all of our space is being taken up, or a lot of it, by COVID patients.
Yeah, but you're not seeing that message resonate, I guess, is what you're saying, that it's been said and been said and been said, and it's not changing
over
the behaviors.
And then, to be frankly honest with you too, right? We have politicians saying that maybe they're not as full as they say they are, or that it's partly our fault for mismanaging whatever, you know, HR
right.
stuff. So one, I don't think people hear the message, but even if they did, we're being contradicted as well.
You know, I've so far avoided the fact that the pandemic has become politicized, and that the science around the health measures, that's become fodder for talking heads, or become part of the sort of the divide in American society. And I don't know, as we wrap up here, I'm just wondering, you know, you say, Dr. Spivak, that message about what's happening in the healthcare system isn't getting through. I guess, is there anything that is getting through? Or is there anything that you are finding is useful? I guess, can anybody's mind be changed? And have you seen anything like that happen on your end?
No, I think that there's been one-off conversations that I've had that have changed people's minds. I mean, I'll admit I'm cynical on a large scale. This entire problem right now, we are where we are because of our tribal political nature system, whatever you want to call it, in this country. And so I don't think you can avoid talking about it, because we are in the situation we are in because of our political, you know, systems. Yeah, I think there are people that their minds can be changed. The problem is, there's so many people unvaccinated, we need large scale mind changing. And I don't know how to make that happen, or very optimistic about that.
Stephen Goldstein?
Yeah, I mean, what can I say that's really any different than that? I mean, I think we're gonna be dealing with this virus. The virus, like I said, it's not gonna go away completely. If we could get, you know, a very high percentage of the population vaccinated, then I think the virus would be around, but we wouldn't really have to spend too much time thinking about it. But as long as we're stuck around this 50-55% vaccination number, you know, we're still going to be dealing with this virus for a while at a pretty disruptive level. And it's hard to see what kind of seismic change is going to occur that's going to send us all the way up to suddenly up to an 85 or 90% vaccination level, unfortunately.
Dr. Stephen Goldstein is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Utah. Dr. Emily Spivak is an infectious disease physician at University of Utah Health. Thank you both for coming back and making time for the show again.
Yeah, of course.
Thank you.
As always, we are curious about how you are thinking about all of this. Send us your pandemic-related questions, but also send us your other questions about your community, about anything, really, and we'll try to provide the service of getting answers. That is it for In the Hive from KCPW, a listener-supported, entirely independent, local public radio resource. Podcasts of this show are findable out there in the world of podcasts. I'm Roger McDonough. I appreciate your attention and time. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week.